Thanks, Simon. So we'll start again. I'm changing topics, moving on to FICE. I'm handing over to Uni. You're in Korea, are you?
Yeah,
Late night for
I
you. Okay, thank
Yeah,
you.
10 p.m. Not too bad. So, good afternoon, board members. Just to recap, at the December 2019 board meeting, the board started its discussion on the classification of financial instruments that will or may be settled in the issuer's own equity instruments. In particular, the board explored what clarification could be made to the underlying principle of the fixed-for-fixed condition and whether particular types of adjustment would not preclude the derivative being classified as an equity instrument. These clarifications would supplement and not replace the fixed-for-fixed condition. In addition, the board considered how the proposed clarified principle would apply to some of the practice issues. Based on the input provided by board members at that meeting, the staff have further developed the analysis on the fixed-for-fixed condition and present two agenda papers in this month's meeting. So now Angie will tee up each paper in turn and pause for questions and comments.
Thank
Thanks,
you.
Uni. Thanks, Uni. Good afternoon, board members. So, Agenda Paper 5A discusses the foundation principle underpinning the fixed-for-fixed condition and analyzes potential clarifications that could be made to that principle in response to some of the observations made at the December board meeting. The staff would like to emphasize that in all cases, the classification is based on the perspective of the issuer of the underlying equity instruments. So that is the entity that has a derivative on own equity and not necessarily the entity that has issued the derivative. And by underlying equity instruments, the staff mean those equity instruments that are used to settle a derivative. In this paper, the staff present two alternatives to articulate the foundation principle. Alternative A, discussed in paragraph 16 to 25, is a direct refinement of the foundation principle discussed in December, whereas alternative B, discussed in paragraphs 26 to 30, is an alternative way to articulate the foundation principle based on the certainty of the amount of cash exchanged per unit of equity instrument. The staff note that these alternatives, when used in conjunction with the adjustment principles discussed in Agenda Paper 5B, are not intended to result in different classification outcomes. Instead, they are intended to be different ways to articulate the proposed rationale for the fixed-for-fixed condition. This rationale is that a derivative on own equity should be classified as equity if and only if the issuer's rights and obligations are similar to those that it would have had if it issued or reacquired the underlying equity instruments for cash or another financial asset instead. The staff prefer alternative B because of the potential limitations of alternative A discussed in paragraph 25. Also, alternative B is closer to the wording in IS 32 and does not use new concepts such as settlement value, which we think will make it easier for stakeholders to understand and implement. In paragraphs 32 to 38, the staff explore how the proposed foundation principle using alternative B is applied to a number of illustrative examples. Finally, in paragraphs 39 to 43, the staff discuss share-for-share exchanges, which are contracts that are settled by the issuer exchanging one type of its own non-derivative equity instruments for another type of its own non-derivative equity instruments. Now, IS 32 does not specifically address share-for-share exchanges. The staff's view is that a contract that will or may be settled by exchanging a fixed number of two types of non-derivative own equity instruments should be classified as equity. By issuing such a contract, the issuer will or may be extinguishing one type of own equity with another type of own equity. The value of shares received in exchange may be different from the value of shares delivered. However, consistent with the rationale for the foundation principle, such a contract would not impose any additional obligations on the issuer or give any additional rights to the issuer compared to a scenario in which it issues and reacquires the underlying equity instruments directly. I'll now turn the discussion over to the board members for any comments or questions on the staff's proposed clarifications to the foundation principle before we ask for tentative decisions.
Okay. Tadao.
Thank you, Sue. First, thank you for the team for preparing this, let's say, very practical paper. It's a very good one. I really enjoyed that one. Of course, I tried to exercise my imagination, thinking about the instruments. But I have just one comment on this. In paragraph 33 and 34, there are some examples. I understood the focus is on the conversion ratio, but especially on the example in paragraph 34, I think it would be worth also working with one example with variable interest rate, just to make clear that provided that I have a fixed conversion ratio, I still get the equity classification. I mean that even if I have a variation in the amount that will be converted, provided that the conversion ratio is fixed, I still get the equity classification. Is it correct, Angie?
Yes, so the focus is on the fixed exchange ratio. So it doesn't matter whether the interest rate is variable or fixed rate. It would cover both of those cases.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I can't see any. Jingqiao, and then I'll come in. Jingqiao?
Yes, yeah. Several, maybe two or three clarifications. First, about identifying the issue of the underlying equity instrument. If there is a subsidiary issued that underlying equity instrument within the group, so that the subsidiary issued that underlying equity instrument, but based on the paragraph 8C, we mentioned this case. In this case, the issue of the underlying equity instrument should not be that subsidiary, should be the group. Is my understanding correct? From group perspective, is what we are going to?
So I think what we were trying to explain there was that if a subsidiary issues a derivative over its own equity, then the subsidiary will be the issuer. But if another group entity issues a derivative over that subsidiary share, then the group will be the issuer. So we were just trying to clarify who is the issuer of the underlying equity instruments in a situation where, in a group situation where one group entity issues derivative over another entity's equity instruments. In those cases, it is the group that's the issuer.
Okay, so the group, yeah, okay. So second question about functional currency. Suppose the functional currency of of the subsidiary is different from the group, and the group's functional currency.
From the parent.
Yeah, from the parent, I suppose, yeah. The parent's functional currency is different from the subsidiary's, you know, functional currency. So based on our foundation principle, I think it should be the easiest functional currency. So that means should it be the group's functional currency, or rather than the subsidiary's functional currency?
Because a group in itself does not have a functional currency, we will look to the entity that issues the underlying equity instrument. So we will assess whether the derivative contains any foreign currency variable based on the subsidiary's functional currency.
So in this case, it's the subsidiary's functional currency.
That matters, yeah. Yep. Because a group in itself does not have a functional currency.
But when the group consolidated financial statement, they will always, okay,
no,
that is the presentation. That is the presentation for currency. Yeah, okay, it's
correct.
Yeah. But in this case, come back to the first question. Because first question, we say the issuer of the underlying equity instrument is the group rather than the subsidiary. But the second question say the functional currency actually is the subsidiary rather than the parent. It seems that there's some, you know, inconsistency here. Because that, we focus on the easy. Yeah.
That came from the work that we did when we were doing the discussion paper, actually, didn't it?
Yeah.
That's addressed at the staff. That's my recollection.
Yeah. So there was when the board was developing the 2018 discussion paper, then it considered which entity's functional currency should be the reference point if you're trying to assess, what's the effect of foreign currency in the consolidated financial statements. So the board at that point came to the view that you look at the functional currency of the entity whose equity instruments form the underlying of the derivative. So that's why in your example, if it's the subsidiary shares that are being delivered, then you would look at the subsidiary's functional currency.
Okay, so I'll come and then just so people know who I've noticed, then I'll let in Mary, Anne, and Martin, and then Gary. So firstly, thank you for these papers. I thought they were very good, very clear, and deceptively simple language for a complicated topic. And I liked the rearticulation of alternative B. I think it's a very neat use of simple language to explain the point, and I think it does a good job of building Watson 32 and explaining that rather than coming up with something brand new, which is what our sort of homework assignment was. So that was good. One thing I spent a bit of time puzzling over was the focus on what the underlying equity instrument was, and I just wanted to say I thought that was quite neat. I think it's quite neat for a couple of reasons, assuming I understand it now, because it's really making sure that you've got two things going on. One is that because we focus on what's used to settle the derivative, it's very close to this idea of an exchange of a fixed number of shares for a fixed amount of cash, because you're focusing on what's delivered, which is neat. And also because you're focusing on the instrument used to settle a derivative, it creates the link to which equity price risk it is that you need to have the variation linked to in this whole idea of fixed for fixed. So I like that articulation you've got there. I think it's quite subtle, but I think it's clever and it's achieving a couple of things with a simple idea. So I wanted to say that I supported that. So thank you. Mary?
I'll start by seconding your congratulations and thanks for the very clearly written and very focused papers and some really good developments of in areas where we've had challenges to date. It's something that I've corresponded with the staff, but wanted to clarify here is when we are talking about something, an amount being fixed, what we're talking about is the book value rather than the fair value of an instrument. And I'm thinking, for example, about a convertible bond. When we're talking about the specified amount of the carrying value liability rather than its fair value. And I think that's important because the fair value could be impacted, for example, by fluctuations in interest rates that would impact the fair value of the principal, the amount of the liability. But it's implicit but not explicit in the paper that what we're focused on is, it seems, it's not criminal value. Could you, Angie or Uni, maybe comment on that?
Yeah, that's correct. So we don't mean the fair value. We mean the fixed units of functional currency, be it the principal or accrued interest. So we mean the rather the notional amount, or I think which would be close to book value.
It's the amount due under the bond, so it's really nothing to do with accounting carrying amounts. Yeah?
Yes.
So you've got £100 due or something on the bond, or you can take the shares. That's what you're focusing on, isn't it, Uni?
Yeah, that's right.
I think it's maybe easier to answer in each specific case, like if you're thinking about a convertible bond example. But as we think across the range of possibilities, including settlement of different liabilities, I think we'll just have to think about whether the articulation works. I support that focus. I'm not trying to drive it to fair value, but I just think we have to watch out for that as we work through different examples.
Yep, we'll be clear on that.
Okay, thanks. And next, then Martin, then Gary.
Yeah, I also wanted to say that I like this alternative B, this articulation. I think it is very clear and easier if we refer to settlement value and this kind of thing. So I really like it. And also then, okay, it is then makes clear what kind of adjustment are allowed and what not. But I only asking the question, is it a principle? I think it is a better articulation of the fix-to-fix what we have. The principle, I would think it is not a kind of principle, and maybe we should use another term or different articulation what was used today, but I think it is not a principle. The principle, I think, for me is more what you said in the beginning of the presentation. It was a kind of, okay, if kind of it is not in a different situation compared to an issue of own equity or buying back own equity, and then you adjust for derivative elements which you have and other things. And that is a principle, but I think that is the articulation more what we have established in IAS 32 for the fix-to-fix, what was a little bit difficult to understand, and that is a better articulation and easier to understand of that. I would see it this way.
Okay, thanks, Martin. Anne?
Thanks, Sue. I also support alternative B. I know Angie said that it's both ways are saying the same thing, but I did find alternative B quite a lot clearer once I focused in on this idea of one equity instrument and a certain amount of currency, i.e. a price. I found that much more helpful than alternative A. And then we've also got the idea that it's more strongly linked to the underlying part of IAS 32, paragraph 16b2. So I liked that. And then when we did go forward into paper 5b and we start looking at the preservation adjustments and passage of time adjustments, I felt that the examples, when I tried to apply the principle in alternative B, or whatever we choose to call it, but the ideas of alternative B into those examples, I found that that worked better for me as well, rather than alternative A. So I do support the staff on that. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Gary?
Thank you. Much of what I'm going to say has just been repeated in the last 5 minutes. But first of all, I absolutely support alternative B, and, you know, trying to put myself back in a former life as a preparer, whether it's FICE type products or just FI in general, just trying to understand what the economics of them were often was difficult, not to mention the accounting. So I look at paragraph 30 in here. Again, I read this, if I was a preparer, I had to apply the standard. Is it clear to me what you want to do? And I think paragraph 30 there, its beauty is its simplicity. So if an issuer does not know how many functional currency units it's going to receive, pay, it doesn't qualify for equity classification. That's evergreen. And I think it will exist as new products are going to emerge all the time. I think this will last a long time. And its beauty is it's simple. Most preparers can understand the words, you know, without needing, you know, national office expertise or the investment bankers walking you through it, and so on. So this is a really good place we're coming out.
Okay, Rika.
Thank you, Sue. I also support the staff's
recommendation on alternative D, because it's a lot easier to looking at exchange ratio at initial recognition rather than looking at the value of the settlement date. So I definitely support the staff recommendation.
Chengwu?
Yeah, I agree with the step recommendation. Alternative is much easier to understandable. And I'd like to thank you for your well-analyzed paper. But one minor editorial comment is, why don't you, use cash rather than functional currency units in the kind of a description of fundamental principle, and put that discussion of the functional currency units in a separate paragraph. That will make all the expressions in the body of the text paper or in the examples analysis, you can save a lot of things because you don't have to say repeat the functional currency units. Also, some non-professional accountants might read our standards. So if we think their capability to understand what our kind of a fundamental principle of debt and equity classification, it might be easy to use cash rather than functional currency units. But if you add another separate paragraph with the functional currency units, we can have the same outcome. So that's my suggestion. Thank you.
Staff, did you use functional currency units because cash is too narrow? Because, for example, of the convertible bond being handed over? Yeah?
That, and as well, that cash could be in any currency. And so if my cash amount is denominated in a foreign currency, just reading the principle on its own where it says, well, it's a fixed amount of cash. If that fixed amount is different to my functional currency, then I'm not... I still have a variable amount, and so and that is where a lot of practice issues is coming from, and we know there are people that don't like that. So I think we would just try to be super clear from the outset that it's always your functional currency that we are looking at.
Okay. Maybe we can use examples to make it clear that sometimes that's as simple as a cash amount in your functional currency. Okay, with that, can we get a vote, show of hands on question one? We won't vote on the word principle in case we think of a different word, but do we agree with the staff's recommendation to go with alternative B? Could I get a show of hands, please? And on the phone, Francoise, are you supportive of alternative B?
Yes, I am.
Okay, 13, one absent.
Great. Hand back to you, Angie.
Sue, so there's just the second part on that paper. There's another question about the share-for-share exchange, if we can just get a vote on that.
If people are happy to vote on that as well, a show of hands for the second question. And Francoise?
Yes.
Okay.
13, one absent.
Okay, so we can move on to paper 5B.
Right. Okay, agenda paper 5B discusses the adjustment principle, which could be used to classify derivatives, and considers the input provided by board members at the December board meeting. The staff would like to point out that an entity would apply the adjustment principle when the foundation principle is not met because there are adjustments in a contract that could alter the number of underlying equity instruments or the amount of cash that will be exchanged. So two types of adjustments are discussed in this paper. And I'll tee up each type of adjustment separately and then pause for questions and comments after each one. In paragraph 7 to 19, the staff discuss preservation adjustments, which are aimed at preserving the relative economic interests of the potential or future equity instrument holder and the existing underlying equity instrument holder. An example of a preservation adjustment is an adjustment that compensates the future shareholder if there's an event that benefits the existing shareholder. So if there's a share split or a share consolidation. The staff present two alternatives to describe the preservation adjustments that would be allowed in an equity classified derivative. Applying alternative A, only adjustments that require the issuer to preserve the relative economic interests of the future shareholders and the existing underlying equity instrument holders to an equal extent would be allowable. So this means that the preservation adjustment is applied in a symmetric way. So any adjustment that does not treat the future shareholders and the existing underlying equity instrument holders equally would result in a financial asset or a financial liability classification. On the other hand, applying alternative B, adjustments are considered allowable if they require the issuer to preserve the relative economic interests of the future shareholders to an equal or a lesser extent than the existing underlying equity instrument holders. As illustrated in paragraph 18, alternative A results in inconsistent classification outcomes for different levels of compensation to future shareholders. So this will make it difficult for the users of financial statements to understand, and it may also create a possibility for structuring to achieve a particular accounting outcome. Alternative A also appears to lack a conceptual basis, considering that equity represents a residual interest. The staff therefore prefer alternative B because it solves the challenges under alternative A. I'll now turn the discussion over to the board members for any comments or questions on the staff's proposed clarifications to the preservation adjustment principle.
Okay, so any questions or comments on the preservation adjustment part of paper 5B? Daryl?
So Angie, just thinking about the difference between A and B, so A essentially says it has to be symmetrical in order for it to apply. But I am correct in saying that if there is no preservation adjustment at all, in other words, no adjustment has been included in, then we don't look to see whether or not the nature of the transaction is fair towards. So for example, if I've locked in a particular exchange rate, but I subsequently have a dilution event and that dilution event is not reflected in the agreement, then even though that would be disadvantageous to the holder of the equity instrument, we would be ignoring that because if there's no preservation adjustment, we don't think about it at all.
Yes, that's right. So then that means that you would meet fixed for fixed already because there's no adjustments to that exchange ratio in the contract.
So I mean, it seems to point to us saying that preservation is not in itself a principle. We're only attesting what should happen in the circumstance that there is a preservation adjustment. And I think that probably leans me towards B, because then what we're trying to do is we're trying very specifically to establish that there's not an adjustment in place that will cause harm to the existing shareholders, and therefore asymmetric makes sense. So it just helps me clarify my thinking a little bit, but that leaves me in the space of supporting B.
Supporting B? Yeah. Okay, Tom?
Correct. Yeah, I strongly support B on this issue, because I think when we had the preservation adjustment that was equal, to me, if I launch all this from a plain vanilla option, which currently is unequivocally equity, the plain vanilla option doesn't satisfy this departure rule. So it was bound to create a discrepancy or a gap, which is exactly what it did. And the staff point out that's what you get in a big gap. Because the point you're departing from doesn't satisfy your rule for how you depart. And again, if you just stop and think for a second, if 100% is going to be treated as equity, suppose I had a plain vanilla option that's treated as equity, and I move away and I give 0.1% of protection to the option holder, it would be almost indistinguishable from the plain vanilla option. Would you really want that to come out with a liability classification? And so I think B then becomes the obvious answer. And then I think what the staff do is reasonable, in the sense that the old 100% becomes now a maximum, under the view that you don't want to go beyond, and there's some logic to that, and I might kind of want to come back to that. But I think that is a logical place to think about stopping. How far away from the no protection do you go? And so this nicely picks up 1%, 50%, 75%, and the staff say stop at 100%, and they provide some rationale for that. So I think B is to me a really clear choice of the two.
Okay, thanks, Tom. Mary, did you want to come in?
Yes, please. Just a comment, and maybe it goes back a bit to Daryl's question. I also am supportive of approach B on the on this item, but I wanted to think about how we communicate this, and I think the way we communicate it is subject to Martin's point about whether or not we have what is really a principle for the basic fix to fix. That in these two adjustment categories, the preservation adjustment and the passage of time adjustment, we're talking about granting some relief from a really strict application of the principle. I don't think it's a practical expedient, but I think it would be helpful in the long run for us to explain this as relaxing the principle slightly for these two specific categories, assuming we go ahead with both, because I think that that's a bit, Daryl, how we get to why you don't need to consider it at all if it's an absolutely pure fixed for fixed, and why we're not hung up on the absence of preservation adjustment. And so I just wanted to offer that communication suggestion.
Okay, thank you. With that, can I get a show of hands for who on the board supports alternative B for the preservation adjustment? Françoise?
Yes, yes.
13, 1 absent.
Okay, Angie, moving on to the passage of time adjustment.
Thanks, Sue. So in paragraphs 20 to 25 of the paper, the staff discuss passage of time adjustments, which compensate either the issuer or the holder of a derivative for changes in the timing of exercise of a derivative or changes in the exercise dates of the option. The staff analyze four alternative ways to specify what is an allowable passage of time adjustment in an equity classified derivative. So in summary, applying alternative A, the adjustment should be predetermined at inception of the contract and vary only with the passage of time. So if this is the case, then there's no need to perform any further assessment. The staff would like to clarify that predetermined in this context generally means a predetermined fixed amount per share at each predetermined exercise date. However, predetermined could also mean a predetermined formula, as long as the inputs to the formula only vary with time. Applying alternative B, the adjustment should have the effect of fixing the cash amount per share in terms of a present value. So in addition to being predetermined and vary only with the passage of time. Compared to alternative A, alternative B would result in a smaller population of adjustments being allowable because alternative B requires an additional test. The quantum of the adjustment therefore needs to be analyzed further to determine if adjustments over time are done in a proportionate manner to represent compensation for passage of time. Applying alternative C, the adjustment should be predetermined, only vary with the passage of time, and also be reasonable. And judgment would need to be applied to determine what is reasonable. So taking into consideration things like the maturity of the derivative, the time between two or more exercise dates, and other relevant factors. And then lastly, applying alternative D, the only requirement here is for the adjustment to be reasonable. So similar to alternative C, again, judgment needs to be applied to determine what is reasonable. But unlike alternatives A to C, there's no requirement for the adjustment to be predetermined and to vary only with the passage of time. So that means that if the adjustment is based on a formula with inputs other than time, that can also be allowable if it is considered reasonable. And depending on how the board defines what is reasonable, alternative C could be the most strict option, but alternative D is likely to be the least strict option. So on balance, the staff prefer alternative B, We note that the fix for fix condition in IS-32 does not require an assessment of whether the pricing of a derivative is reasonable or whether a contract is at market in order to be classified as an equity instrument. Rather, the assessment is about whether there's variability in rights and obligations of the contract. And although alternative A would be in line with this principle, alternative B goes a step further, and it would limit the scope for any abuse and ensure that there is this relationship between how the stepped amounts were determined and time. And alternative C and D would require more subjective assessments, so they may have unintended consequences. And then lastly, in paragraph 26 to 36 of the paper, the staff explore how the proposed adjustment principles are applied to a number of illustrative examples of financial instruments containing features that are common in practice. So I'll now turn the discussion over to the board members for any comments or questions on the staff's proposed clarification to the passage of time adjustment principle before we ask for tentative decisions.
Okay, I'm going to comment on this one. So I had to remind myself when I was reading this that it wasn't the day for me to sit and think about, you know, what my, you know, fundamental concepts and brand new ideas might be, but to sort of look back at what our objective is here, which is to take the current logic we've got in 32 and to try and flesh it out and explain it a bit better. And we've only got fixed for fixed at the moment, so it's not a very fancy concept that we've got to start with. Given that, I would be happy either with alternative A or alternative B. I'm happy to go with the staff recommendation. It's fairly straightforward. I wouldn't get into the complexity of C and D because I don't think we really had designed fix for fixed in the first place as a very sophisticated concept where you should be able to put very structured things into it. Going back to Mary's point, read literally, at least today, 32 only allows pure fixed for fixed. So all of this is sort of softening those lines. And so I think we should remember that. And I'm not sure that using something like the concept of the IFRS 9 concept of interest would really be appropriate here, because that was designed for what's a basic lending arrangement. And there's more going on in these things than just lending money, because, for example, you may or may not have an option exercise, so there's time value concepts and things going on. So I would prefer sticking with the simplicity as the staff have recommended. Mary, did you want to come in?
Yes, I just didn't have mute right to hand. On this one, I am tending more towards approach C, not because I want to be strict for the sake of being strict, but rather going back to that point of thinking about this as a bit of a relaxation of the strict fixed for fixed principle. If what we're saying in the passage of time is we're relaxing it, if what you're trying to do is allow for the, you know, is adjust for the passage of time, then I would be C, but I would not be D, because I, even though it's subjective, judgmental, I would like somebody to have to say, yes, that's reasonable for the passage of time. And I wouldn't get into building out guidance on what's reasonable, specifying parameters, etc. And I'm not troubled by the fact that we would be putting reasonableness conditions on something that was a relaxation when we don't put it on the instrument itself. So there's no requirement, for example, for the option premium to be reasonable considering the strike price, the expected volatility, et cetera. Just, you know, the instrument is what it is. But I think when we're talking about we'll grant relaxation, I am tending more to thinking about, and you know, us saying in this one, okay, you can have some adjustment for the passage of time, and I'd like to go on to say, but you have to reach the conclusion that it's the amount of the adjustment is reasonable for the passage of time. So I'm C rather than.
My reservation with that, Mary, is that what an investment banker thinks is reasonable for the passage of time on a structured equity derivative could be pretty interesting. Anne?
Yes, that was my worry about this reasonable. So I discounted D, and I wasn't keen on C either, because part of the things we're trying to do in this area of work is take away the exercise of judgment to arrive at a structured product that fits the needs of the desires of people. So the building in reasonable, I think, means that we do get people with different opinions about what fits and what doesn't fit. So because of what we're trying to aim to do, to give more clarity and to take away some of the diversity that currently exists in how people treat things, I didn't favour using reasonable, so I would favour alternative B.
Mary, do you want a right of rebuttal?
Well, I guess it's not so much rebuttal as question. I may be missing something. To Angie and Uni in particular, I think of C as additive to B. And I think if we're saying, and it has to be reasonable, I think this is the difference between C and D. D just says it's got to be reasonable. But I think C adds on to B by saying, and that compensation has to be reasonable. I accept that because that could be a very judgmental / subjective test, the additional hurdle that it adds is maybe not very high, but I don't think it would open the door to things that would otherwise have failed B. Am I reading them correctly in terms of C being
edited? What an investment banker's going to think, Mary. What an investment banker's going to think is reasonable based on an option pricing model for a one-year option versus a three-year option is not going to be just, is that an appropriate discount rate? It's going to be about equity volatility. It's going to be about all the different paths of share prices. It's going to be a whole load of funky things which you're not even thinking about.
Let me just check what you're saying. I think what you're saying is that they are likely to come to conclusions that a lot of things that I think would have been unreasonable are indeed reasonable for this instrument. So, but again, this is on top of having to already meet the requirements of alternative B, which is that it is just for the passage of time. I think this is a problem and can open the door is fair if reasonable was the only test, which is true for D, like David.
I'm just saying the passage of time is a complicated concept in option pricing. It's not just about time value of money.
Yeah.
So when we say passage of time and is reasonable, I think that can be read in many different ways by structured equity guys.
Hmm. Yeah, but I think because alternative C builds on A, perhaps the risk of structuring might be limited compared to alternative D, as Mary explained. But I think the question about what is reasonable and the diversity in opinion as to what is reasonable will be there. So that problem will still exist under alternative C. And I think as Anne pointed out, I think that could lead to diversity and more interpretation type questions.
I think there might also be a bit of, what is considered reasonable for the passage of time in one jurisdiction might not be necessarily reasonable in another jurisdiction. So if you compare a high interest rate jurisdiction with somebody that's got a low interest rate, what we consider or what people in those jurisdictions consider to be reasonable might be different, which again then leads to potential interpretation questions about, is this reasonable? So if we do go down the route of, alternative C or D, when we say it should be reasonable, I don't think we can get away from describing or saying what you need to say is reasonable in the context of. So we can't just leave it at it needs to be reasonable. I think we need to explain. Otherwise, I just think we're going to have just as many interpretation or diversity and practice questions as we currently have.
So I'm busy trying to assimilate the conversation we've just had as we or taking the conversation we've just had as we've been talking. So under alternative B, you're required to determine the present value, and that present value should be the same present value for each of the successive dates going into the future. So there's an assumption that there's a core present value calculation. To determine present value, you need to be able to determine an interest rate that applies for the purposes of getting that interest rate. Now, I think where Mary may have been coming from is whether or not, and Mary, you can confirm whether this makes sense to you, but you were seeing C as perhaps being a control mechanism over the interest rate that you would use for the purposes of determining present value. And so that's why you were seeing C as being additive to B. Whereas I think the way staff had set up C, and certainly the way I understood Sue was describing C, is that the adjustment was predetermined, but it didn't necessarily have to be based on a present value type of principle. It just needed to be reasonable. So if, for example, there was an assumption that the share price would go up and then go down, it would be reasonable for the strike price to go up and then go down.
Yeah.
Is in that, that's a distinction between the two. It does mean that under alternative B, we are still to a certain extent leaving open how you would determine the interest rate that you apply for the present value. Is that correct?
Yeah, under alternative B wouldn't question how that discount rate is set.
Absolutely. So it's just a matter of you use a discount rate, and as long as that discount rate tracks to the strike price over time. And I think probably for that sort of summary of where I think Sue and Mary was landing is probably why I'm comfortable in B, or probably could have been made comfortable in A. And I think it's because what we're essentially saying, I think, under alternative A and alternative B is that an entity could just as easily let me leave it at that point. But I'm very happy to go with the staff recommendation of B.
Martin?
Yes, I'm also happy with B, and I also thought about if you should go to Z because about this reasonable passage of time adjustment, but I think already in B, I think there is a kind of implicit that it should be reasonable because it is an adjustment for passage of time and should not be for anything else. So it is a kind in the name, it is already included. But if we make it explicit in alternative C, I think people will ask, what do you mean by that? And then we have to explain what we think is a reasonable passage of time for this kind of instruments, which I think is very, very difficult. So I'm happy with B. And I also think it is already included because this adjustment is for the passage of time or not for anything else.
Tadao, and then Tom.
Thank you, Sue. When we look at countries with high inflation and or high interest rates, sometimes adjusted strike price indexed to an inflation index or benchmark interest rate is in substance just trying to compensate for the time value of the money, definitely not leverage transaction. And when I read the paragraph 36, the example that we have there, I understood that if we have any of this strike price index to, for example, the inflation, local inflation index, it would not qualify as an equity instrument under alternatives A, B, and C. And I really think that it makes sense because it's not leveraging or linked to the underlying option. It's just the bit of the option that is related to the passage of time. That's I thought that alternative D would be reasonable in this type of situation. I acknowledge all the challenges we have behind this alternative, but I just want to make the point that in countries with high inflation and high interest rate, definitely indexing to, for example, a local inflation, it's not leveraging the transaction, and sometimes from the substance, I think that could still qualify as an equity instrument. I know that's not in the text of IS 32 today, but reviewing the text, I would think that we could make it work. This.
Okay, thank you, Tom, and then Gary.
I have a couple of different ways of looking at this. I want to just go back, and one of the ways I've been thinking about it is I sort of start with this plain vanilla option that is unequivocally equity, and I think about it. And With respect to that, there was, as we've gone through the various conceptual frameworks, there were various times people have suggested that just common share equity should be equity and everything else should be a liability. And that's been regularly rejected. So I just want to kind of remind, why is a plain vanilla option, why did people not want it to be a liability? And if you think about the transaction when you issue one, you're going to get some resources. And if you treated it as a liability, you're going to put it on the balance sheet. And the signal the balance sheet is going to give you is that financial risk has increased. Yet financial risk in the way we normally see it doesn't increase, in that your ability to meet your obligations as they come due is not affected. Your risk of bankruptcy is not affected. In fact, it's down because you have more resources. As well, on the income statement, if you had a plain vanilla option, you treat it as a liability. Then every time you had economic good news that was reflected first in the price of the shares and the option, you would increase your liability, you would decrease your income. And because economic news often hits price first, you'd be constantly getting these things on the income statement and the balance sheet that were not consistent with the underlying economics that was happening to the firm. And I think there were other reasons plain vanilla options were not made liabilities, but I think that sort of running counter to the underlying economics was a major factor. So then when I think about this, I tend to depart from, so as I depart from a plain vanilla, and even in the first case, I eventually decided the staff at 100% was a okay place to stop. But even in a round down, and I went and looked at round downs, and I asked myself the question, of the price of a plain vanilla option, if I add a round down feature, how much of the price of this new thing is attributable to the plain vanilla versus the round down? I couldn't get descriptive statistics, but I did find a good example. And in the example, the round down was worth between 2 to 5% of the price. And I'm still okay with us making that a liability, but I am somewhat troubled that of the price movements, 95% of it's coming from the plain vanilla and 5% is coming from the feature that's going to make it a liability. I think I'm still okay to be there. But I do pose that question when we look at the alternatives A, B, and C, and D, is that whatever we add, if we had, say, want to add some of these where you have more than one exercise date, what is that adding to the price of the option? I don't think a lot. And I think, so then we'll have some very small percentage of the value of the option driving a liability classification. And that worry leads me back to a simpler thing, which might be A, because I'm really not keen, for the reasons I don't want plain vanilla options to be liabilities, I don't necessarily want to shove all kinds of things into liability that have these drawbacks on the income statement and the liability side. So I have that other issue when I look at A and B. And then I think when I do, the other thing that comes up on this one that concerns me is sort of, again, to economic substance. Almost any of these things where you have, say, 2 or 3 exercise points, if you took them apart, you could issue option A, option B, option C. And if we did the example that the staff have, they have 100, 200, 300 in one case, I think, and 100, 200, 500 in the other. And the 500 clearly has something else going on. But in either case, if you split them and made them all separate options, they'd be equity. No question. And so the 500 would be equity and the 300 would be equity. They'd both be equity. So now I put them together, and even that, I don't see that there's necessarily a problem there, because I don't see there's any opportunity for abuse in the sense that the one with the 300 in the third year and the one with the 500 is going to be priced less. You're going to get less from the option holder than the one with the 300. So it's taken care of in the price they pay. I don't think it's an abuse issue. But for some reason, they put a different structure in these options. So then I'm kind of back to, should all this trigger this liability classification when individually they wouldn't be liabilities, and it brings all this difficulty onto the balance sheet and the income statement? And I think I agree that we probably, because we're starting from the fixed for fixed base, and I'm cognizant of what Mary said, we're providing relief from not just sticking there. So I'm okay to do all this stuff, but I'm inclined that A would work simply. It's dealing with passage of time. And it's not going to start driving things into liability classification that I really, as I said, I don't see any opportunity for abuse. And even in B, where would you set the line? So if 300 to 500 is unreasonable, is 300 to 320? And it would, A would just save us a whole pile of guidance and difficulty. So I like A for two reasons, or three reasons. It's simple. It doesn't drive stuff into liabilities that really, most of the instrument is, we really don't want to be a liability. And then it saves us with having to do a bunch of guidance.
Gary, you were next.
Yes, thank you. Of the alternatives, for reasons that other people have discussed, I prefer A and B. And I don't know if I have a preferential order of them. I think they both work, and maybe they could, in theory, coexist. Although someone usually likes judgment and reasonable answers and so on, given the nature of what this is about, I would be very nervous if I was a preparer by saying the standard is reasonableness. So as you articulated, investment bankers and you have structured products will have very, very different views of what is fair value, what is present value, what is reasonable and not. Former life, you know, two or three times a month, some banker was in pitching some structured product. It was very difficult to understand on a good day at some of these things. So if it gets down to reasonable, there'll be what the investment bankers feel is reasonable and a corporate treasurer might happen to agree, they might not, but it wouldn't go forward if the treasurer didn't agree. Then it gets to just corporate accountants, you know, my old role, would you agree it is reasonable? And then the next degree is your auditing firms or national offices will see it differently. And still at the end of the day, then you got a regulator who that you may or may not have to deal with. We'll have another view of what is reasonable. And to some extent, what is reasonable, what is not, is dependent on the individual that you're making that assessment, whether it's the chief accountant, whether it's of a company, whether it's a regulator, whether it's an auditor, or so on. So I would be very nervous about reasonable being the standard in this instance. And also, if there's a little bit of a difference of opinion of what is reasonable, what is not, this is not a question of a journal entry to adjust an account on the balance sheet. This makes something from equity to liability or vice versa, has profound implications through the P&L and through earnings per share, perhaps. And quite frankly, the risk isn't worth it if you're a preparer. I would A or B work for me, and C and D do not.
Rika? And then Jun Chao.
Thank you, Sue. I actually started from alternative A. It seemed, I thought that it seemed workable, but when I considered when there is a multiple interval of the exercise days or something like that, in that case, maybe the explanation about the analysis of the adjustment included alternative B seems more helpful to understand where we draw the line in this discussion. So I think my preference now is alternative B, but depending on the how support underlying the concept of this discussion, alternative A also works. And I do not support alternative C or D because I don't think we shouldn't give the subjectivity of the playing ground of the assessing the legal numberness in practice.
Rika, Jin Chao?
Thank you, Ronnie.
Jin Chao, I think your microphone is off.
Still can't hear you.
Okay. Yeah.
There you go.
I'm comfortable with alternative A and alternative B, But comparing two approaches, I prefer alternative B. I think alternative B is more reasonable than alternative A, considering the passage of time. But as Delo mentioned, that the key is how to determine the discount rate. I think the concept behind it is that the discount rate should represent the compensation for passage of time. So in my understanding, here the discount rate should only only reflect the time value of the money, or should not consider other factors. Is this correct?
Under alternative B, we would not ask the companies to prove that discount, how they have derived the discount rate. As long as using a single discount rate, you can prove that there is a reasonable relationship between this stepped amount and each exercise date. So it would, we would see that as being more consistent where IS32 is today, where we don't, as long as it's fixed, we don't question how that fixed amount has been set. So in a similar manner, as long as there is a discount rate, the companies will not have to prove or demonstrate that discount rate, how that discount rate reasonably represent the time value of money.
So actually, there are no discipline on the discount rate, how they determine the discount rate. But in addition, if there is no discipline on it, I think we need to require those entities to disclose how they determine the discount rate.
We can look at that when we come back to disclosures. Yeah.
Okay.
With that, should we try, is everybody who wants to speak spoken? Nobody's twitching, okay. So with that, can we vote on question two then and see whether the board agrees that alternative B is the way that we should determine the allowable adjustment for the passage of time?
And Francoise?
Yes.
Okay, so we have 10, one absent.
Okay, good. All right. So that brings us to the end of those papers, I think. Is that right, staff? Yes?
Yep, yep. Thank you very much.
We won't see you for a little while.
Yes, but I'll be back soon enough.
Yeah, you'll be back. We'll look forward to seeing you again, and all the best. I hope for people listening, it's a good example today of things that people don't have to be watching real time. It will be a while before something's put out that people need to comment on, but those who are at home looking for entertainment similarly could watch the meeting or the tape. I think there's better things on the internet at the moment, but, you know, you never know. But it's an example of us moving forward where it's more about us doing things as opposed to asking things of the outside world. With that, that draws today's meeting to a close, and we start again tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. Is that right, nearly? 10 a.m.? Yes, 10 o'clock tomorrow morning. Okay, so with that, that draws today to a close. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
See you.
Thank you.
See you tomorrow.
Bye. Thank you.